all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. We're really happy today to have on Veterans Radio a distinguished journalist, editor, writer, Carlos Harrison is of Miami, Florida. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and has written more than a dozen books, both in English and in Spanish. Carlos, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Jim. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, you've had a fascinating career. I want to tell our listeners a little bit about it to set up the what you brought to the story, The Ghosts of Hero Street, how one small Mexican-American community gave so much in World War II and Korea. But before you got around to writing that, you've done things all over the world. You've been an international correspondent for Fox News Channel. You've done television, screenplays. Interestingly, you've reported on the invasion of Panama and reported clandestinely from inside Cuba at the start of the mass raft exodus in 1994. You've written a wide variety of books, from cookbooks to self-help books, so you know how to write at all kinds of different audience levels. And I think that's part of what makes, in my opinion, having read The Ghosts of Hero Street, so darn readable. You bring all of that to this effort, and I think you did a great job, Carlos.
Well, thank you very much. It sounds really exciting when you say it, all those different things I've done, so thank you.
Well, I'm sure you got a lot of battle scars from it, but no, it's you can. This is a well-written book that is. Well, let's start here. How did you even come up with this idea or this little historical set of facts that launched into this book?
It was actually an offhand comment from one of my dearest friends, who at the time happened to be my boss. I was lucky enough to be the second in command at People's Spanish language edition, People en Español, and my boss and dear friend who had worked at the Miami Herald earlier, and that's how we had met, he said one day, he goes, "You ever heard of a place called Hero Street?" And I said, "No." He says, "We ought to do a story someday." And a couple of years went by, we did a bunch of other things, and we never got around to doing that, but I started looking into it. And what I was able to find was actually one short People magazine piece from the late 60s and one short Reader's Digest piece from about the same time. It was about the time it got officially named as Hero Street. And I fell in love with the idea. I just thought, wow, this is really fascinating. But it just never, you know, things never fell in the right place for us to do it for the magazine. And I moved on and was actually working at another publication. I was back in Florida, and I decided one evening, you know, I'm going to start really working on this. And so I started doing some research, found some phone numbers to some of the relatives of some of the men who died, and started the interviews and went out and worked on it. And it really was, you know, I just fell in love with the story. I guess to give the story for people who don't know it very briefly, this is a block and a half long stretch of the United States. It's really just a few miles from where Ronald Reagan was born, right along the Mississippi River. This is a place that in this block and a half long stretch sent more men, because that's what it was, off to fight in a World War II in Korea than any other similar size stretch anywhere in the country. And it actually eventually earned them the name Hero Street, officially recognized by the Department of Defense, and was bestowed upon them. And so this little place, in a place called Silvis, Illinois, it's close to Moline, Illinois, right across the river from Davenport, Iowa. They sent off in total for World War II, 87 men, and in total for all the way actually through Vietnam, 257 kids, boys.
And what's interesting about this, I think our listeners will find, is that at a time when we have a totally volunteer force and a very small fraction of our population serves, this is the exact opposite. This is a small stretch of folks, and realizing it was a
families.
Time of war.
It's 22 families lived on this block and a half. And when I say lived, we're talking about a dirt street, rocky, hilly dirt street that they carved themselves out of the woods there because they ended up getting boxcars from the railroad that they were invited to work on, and that's what they lived in. No electricity, no running water, boxcars. The kids who grew up there remember the snow blowing in through the cracks in the windows, or cracks in the walls between the slats and the boxcars, and getting up in the morning and having to crack the ice on the wash basin so they could splash some water on their faces before they ran off to school. And they had been forced to live there because even though they had been invited by the railroads up from Mexico to come and live and work, because it was at the tail end and then after World War One when they came up, they needed the manual labor. The railroads did. So they brought these families up, brought them right up there. But then people said, they're Mexicans. They can't live with the rest of us. And so they were forced to live where they could. And that's how they settled along this street. And and this is why, you know, and I've said it a million times, and I really thought of it this way. One of the things I fell in love with the story is because, yeah, we can think of it as, you know, these Mexican families did this and everything else, and it was a different time in history and whatever. But the reality is, to me, it always has been and remains a truly American story. It's a story about people who came here to work hard, to build a better life. And no matter how they were treated, when the time came that the war broke out, they stood up like everyone else and said, this is our home, this is our country, we're willing to fight, we're willing to die for it. And eight of them did. Eight died out of all the ones they sent to fight. And
well,
so,
before we start talking about those who passed and died in the service of the country, let's back up a little bit and talk some more about, because I think it's important to realize this is 1930s, 1940s.
Right.
Life was a lot different then, and the you know, kind of scratching out that they had to do to make their own way, not only through education but finding work and families. Talk to us a little bit about what you learned as you did your research about what it was like back then.
Well, you know, the fact that they didn't have electricity in their boxcars or that they didn't have indoor plumbing sounds shocking to all of us. And obviously it would have been a very rough life, but a whole bunch of the people in the country lived that way too, out on farms all across the Midwest. So that part of their existence, as rough as it may have been, was not that far outside the norm for an awful lot of people. But these were people who, again, it was the end of the Mexican Revolution. And so these were people who their country was war-torn where they were from. They couldn't find work. And the railroads here, as I said, were desperate for manual labor. So they actually went to the border and would invite the people across and then say, yeah, you want a job? They'd say, sure. And they would load them up in Texas on trains and send them all the way up north to keep working on the railroads. And so that's what they did. But scratching out a living for them was, you know, we talk about the victory gardens that people had in the during the war. Well, they had gardens, and remember hobos coming by during the Great Depression and them being nice enough to share with them some of what they had. But they also remember the dark side of being called slurred, being called dirty Mexicans or other things, and actually remember some of the folks I spoke to remember seeing the Ku Klux Klan crosses burning on the hill over their homes to warn them that they were not to step outside certain bounds. They were not allowed to attend the Catholic Church that serviced the rest of their community. So they took two boxcars, put them together, and built their own church, which they named after the patron saint of Mexico, and they called it Our Lady of Guadalupe. And so that's the kind of thing they were growing up in. And basically, sons would follow their fathers. They went off to pick onions from the onion fields over across the river in Iowa in the summer. They would, a lot of them, one of the things that helped them get tougher, but also to keep them in line, was a lot of them fell under the good graces of a basketball coach at the local high school who would get their the basketball shoes that the other players, the wealthier players, or actually the regular kids from the school would throw out. These poor kids would wear those basketball shoes. The other thing was they went to do boxing in what was effectively a PBA kind of thing, a police. It was run by a local cop who taught them to box. And that really kind of came in handy for a lot of them when they went out to fight. They were in tremendous shape when they got to war.
And I can really tell our listeners that as you read the beginning chapters of The Ghosts of Hero Street by Carlos Harrison, you get that sense of community that was because of things like, whether it's the basketball or the boxing or the dances or the church services, you get that. You've done a really nice job, I think, of capturing that community that they all shared until the point where they sign up, and now the men get shipped not only through different services, but really all over the world.
And that was, honestly, from a writer's perspective, I couldn't have been handed such a better canvas to paint, because, as you mentioned, all over the world. I mean, they went, Tony Pompa, the first to die, had gone off to the service. He joined what was the Army Air Corps, actually ended up holding the same spot on a bomber that my dad held, and which was a tail gunner. And basically, because they were a little too tall to be the ball turret gunners, but not so big that they get that they couldn't fit in the cramped space with those twin 50 cal machine guns in the back. And he rode over Italy, and just about 3 weeks after his 19th birthday, was shot down over Aviano, Italy, and crashed, which was actually just a few miles from where I did my service in the Army. So yeah, it was all these things coming together. But that was when I was lucky enough to speak to both a bombardier and a pilot who survived that crash, who were actually with him on board when they were shot down and spent the rest of the war in a German POW camp. But what they described to me helped me. My father passed when I was very young, but it helped me understand a lot about what they had gone through, what my father had gone through, and really to ask myself the question if I could have done it myself. The first day, maybe. The first day, you don't know what's really going to happen. You go up there, you see flak, you see fighters and everything else. Now you come back in a bullet-riddled bomber, flying back, holding, fighting it for 8 hours with no hydraulics to get you limp your way back to the base. And in 48 hours, they're going to say, let's get up and do this again.
Well,
that's
and
when
these,
I think it would be tough, you know?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And again, one of the things you get from reading your book is because these men went all over the world, you get a glimpse of every one of the theaters, really, from Frank Sandoval, who was in Burma, in the sweltering jungle, to a couple of the guys landed were in Normandy and fought through the bitter cold in Belgium.
Battle Bulge.
So we had two of
the first paratroopers in the war, because you've got to remember, in this country we hadn't jumped into combat until World War II. And we had, you know, two men who did that. Willie Sandoval and Peter Macias, who, you know, really died in what up to that time was the largest aerial assault in the history of warfare, which was Operation Market Garden, which many may remember from a movie called A Bridge Too Far and a book of the similar name that that describes how this turned into basically a planning debacle that, you know, left a lot of these men stranded. They didn't get the support that they were expecting and just left and had to just fight it out until they were out of ammunition and in many cases and die. And that's what happened to Willie. And then Peter, in the very next assault, aerial assault, which was the last one of World War II, known as Operation Varsity, he was shot in that one. So I don't know that, you know, looking back, that we can really realize the human toll of the war of this scale, what a world war, and especially with one with the destructive capacity of World War II, what that really meant. But yeah, you're right. And it was, I mean, I learned so much as I read about stuff. Willie, before, prior to Operation Market Garden, was on the beachhead at Anzio, which was, you know, it was just as I described it, it was just a flat griddle for them to get peppered with aircraft bombing them, strafing them, and then the huge Anzio Annie German rail gun firing howitzers at them. And, you know, it's basically digging a hole and try to survive. And in the process, paratroopers who were actually not dropped because they didn't want to alert the Germans, but were shipped in like others to land at the beach, paratroopers like Willie Sandoval earned the nickname of the Devils in Baggy Pants because they were true commandos. They would slip across the lines and the cover of darkness, and very deliberately, Germans were known, and this was found in a German officer's diary, they'd wake up in the morning and find that their foxhole mate had his throat slit in the night, and they had been left there as just a calling card for them, and the other guy had been left alive just to know and to be able to tell the others what happened. So they were one of my friends read the book, a young woman read the book, and she said to me after, she goes, "My God, Carlos," she goes, "did everyone fight that fiercely?" And I said, "Only the ones who wanted to live." You know,
well, listeners, you're going to love this book, The Ghosts of Hero Street by Carlos Harrison. And part of the vividness of it, I think, is you were able to talk to a lot of, in your research, a lot of individuals who knew the men. Talk to us a little bit about how you painted such a vivid picture.
Well, it took a lot of a ton of research. This book actually took me 5 years of interviews and research, not just the families that were relatives and who were also kind enough to share all of the letters home that these men had written. And this was a time, you know, prior to Facebook and being able to do FaceTime on their computers, that people would write themselves letters. And so I learned an awful lot about what happened there. I also poured through thousands of after action reports, which would allow me to see what was happening in a person's unit at the moment that they were there. And so that would tell me about all the battles and where the fighting was and who died and what happened and who made it, and gave me a lot of color there. And then I was also very lucky, even though, you know, we are losing so many of our World War II veterans that, you know, the youngest are in their 90s now, and so they're dying very quickly, and I was lucky enough to find, as I mentioned, among others, the bombardier who was on that plane with Tony Bonfa, the pilot, both of whom passed between the time I spoke with them and the time the book came out. And the same thing happened to a lieutenant who was with Willie Sandoval, or near Willie Sandoval, when he was killed. And I've talked to people who landed in the same landing craft at Anzio. So, you know, between what they would describe, what I had from the reports, and there's been an awful lot of wonderful histories written about World War II that could give me a sense of what was happening, of where to look for more information, and who to talk to.
This is really more of a personal story of what these men went through as compared to big battle plans and whatnot. And I really appreciated that. And your interviewing and all that work comes through the pages and the what I assume are family photos that are in the book as well. Yeah. Really give you that sense of the community, the individuals. As individuals versus just simply part of a cog in a big war machine.
Well, you know, and I'm glad that you say that. Thank you very much for that praise. That, you know, that was kind of a goal. To me, it was always a story about these men who represented this street, which represented these times and represented our country. And so I think, you know, that the story, especially since it then spans the aftermath of World War II and spins off into Korea, which is a totally different kind of conflict with a totally different type of, you know, you basically have a, instead of it being a global conflict, you have a very compact but very brutal, very harsh conditions with a war-weary nation being called upon again to go forth. And yet again, the men at Hero Street stood up, did what they had to do, and one of them won himself a Medal of Honor in the process, going in to fight, because, you know, that was Joe Gomez, and that's what he believed, you know, that you fought and you defended, and it would make a difference. And that's the way they had been raised. And so it did give me an opportunity, I think, to learn a lot personally and to be able to share a lot through very personal stories. So, yeah, thank you for that.
This book is published by the Berkeley Publishing Group of Penguin Group. I assume we can find it on all the natural internet outlets.
And the audiobook is wonderful reading. It's not by me. There's a wonderful audiobook. I mean, the guy really who worked on it did a great job, not just with great voice, but also, you know, called me up to double check some facts and, you know, the pronunciations. He actually was using the galley proof for the audio and caught a couple of errors for me. So I was like, well, thanks. I'm glad we got those fixed. So, I mean, very detailed. It's a wonderful reading. And I guess, you know, we should put in a plug. If you like that book, I hope you'll read the next one that's coming out. I've got one that's coming out. As you can tell, I like these little told or unknown stories of from history that can focus on something like this and tell us a larger story. And the next book is called Trained to Kill, and it is about a man who was a simple accountant, a bank executive in Cuba when Fidel Castro took over, who was trained by the CIA and sent to assassinate Fidel on two different occasions. He put together the master plans to kill Fidel. Obviously, he failed. But in that same process, to talk about how history in this country is so, history everywhere is so so weird and quirky, he was introduced to Lee Harvey Oswald 9 weeks before John Kennedy was killed in Dallas. He was introduced to Lee Harvey Oswald by his CIA handler in Dallas. And it stuck in his mind. Obviously, it didn't say anything like, oh, right, this guy's going to kill the president. But as soon as he saw his picture on TV after the assassination, he said, oh, my God. And
listeners, I can recommend to you The Ghosts of Hero Street by Carlos Harrison, because I've read it and thoroughly enjoyed it. And I want to, I look forward to reading Train to Kill in the spring of 2017 when it comes out. Carlos Harrison, Pulitzer Prize winning author, we want to thank you for your time this afternoon. It's a great book. You did a great job. You've done that, you've done Hero Street proud, and I think you've memorialized a slice of American history that would have otherwise been lost. So you really did a great job. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for taking this time with me.
Well, I want to thank everyone for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the Internet. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcast and Internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.